Okay, well, when Vassius Maximus here to my right first asked me to do this talk, I have to say I was a little bit trepidatious about it. I didn't really know anything about Spartacus at all, so it was something of an adventure. But of course, like any good researcher, the first place I went to try and find out before I read the book that Vashti posted to me in Adelaide was the great font of modern knowledge, Google. And when you type Google, type the word Spartacus into Google, does anybody know, do you think, comes up when you do an image search?
Charlton Heston.
Not Charlton Heston, but we're on the right track.
Make sure you turn the... Yeah, the same
thing. Oh. Thanks, Michael. Hold on a minute, let me just write this down. Actually, maybe I didn't have the safe search up, because when I did it, I got Kirk Douglas, half naked, with half a tunic, looking, you know, pretty resplendent, menacing this little stout Roman sword, charging ahead, sitting astride a horse, a whole army of Roman legions, oh, not Roman legions, Roman slaves around him. You know, we have brave Kirk Douglas, heroic Spartacus. And I think, you know, at one level, thanks Google, this is fairly appropriate, you know, because I think, as Thanasis put it quite eloquently on Thursday night, you know, when people mention the word Spartacus, what really comes to mind is, you know, rebellion, rebel, you know, someone who stands up against authority. And for some of us who maybe aren't as familiar with the story, you know, we may have come across Spartacus, you know, through the 1960 Stanley Kubrick film by that name. I think Vashti suggested to me, oh, we should watch that film. And, you know, in that film, we have a Roman general played by Laurence Olivier, demanding that the bedraggled remnants of the defeated slave army hand over their leader, Spartacus. And Spartacus, you know, Kirk Douglas stands up to say, people might remember if they've seen the film, he says, I'm Spartacus. And his best friend, Antonius, who's Tony Curtis, also half naked, jumps up along with all of the others, all explaining, no, I'm Spartacus. No, I'm Spartacus. And I think people can remember the scene. And, you know, there's an incredible amount of literature, if you just as a side point, on the web about some of the anachronisms in that film. It's amazing how many Roman slaves were wearing watches. But anyway, I don't want to talk just about the epic film, nor do I want to talk for an epic 184 minutes, which is how long that wretched film actually goes for, believe me. I remember, although I must say it's not a bad film. If you want the film, you can find it where I did, which is in a $5 DVD sale bin in suburban Adelaide. I'm sure you can probably find it in your own city. What I do want to talk about is the real Spartacus, the leader of a tremendous slave rebellion in ancient Rome. And this was what's known as the Third Servile War. It was a slave revolt that made the despotic ruling class of Rome absolutely tremble. This happened over 2,000 years ago, 2,084 years ago to be exact, in the first century BC. And it's not a time, of course, that we talk much about unless you're, you know, at a Marxism conference or, you know, one of those kind of pious first-year university arts subjects about the ancient world, or you know, maybe you like to read the Bible, or maybe you're really into Monty Python. It's only relatively recently, though, in human history, in modern history, that Roman history has really been read at all. For a good 1,200 years in Western culture, the history of Spartacus was practically buried. And it was only really 200 years ago that that we have, you know, around the world slavery predominating, a system that helped to build the might of many modern Western empires, the British Empire and the United States most notably. And it was around 200 years ago that some of the first modern struggles against slavery broke out, most notably the struggle of the Haitian slaves in 1807. And it was at that time that the figure of Spartacus again starts to get raised in popular culture. And as you can imagine, it's instantly associated with abolitionism, you know, with actually getting rid of the brutality of slavery. In the 18th and 19th century, the legend of Spartacus is revived and transformed from his infamous archfiend barbarian past to this new icon of progressive politics and liberty. When the Haitian slaves staged their revolt against the French, British and Spanish imperialists, people compared the Haitian revolutionary Toussaint Louverture with Spartacus. as you would do. Although, to be fair, I think it has to be said that unlike Spartacus, Levatua had actually been able to lead the rebellious Haitians to victory and the creation of the first black republic in history. Spartacus's path had involved many initial victories, but the Roman slave rebellions were all ultimately defeated and didn't lead to a radical reconstitution of society in the way that we saw in Haiti. It wasn't long after 1807, though, that a workers' revolution made claim to the legacy of Spartacus. In June of 1848, while Karl Marx was in Paris working on the text of the Communist Manifesto, there appeared a short-lived Parisian weekly paper called, now my French pronunciation is shocking, Le Spartacus Liberateur du Peuple, something or other, I don't know. Anyway, now this periodical was explicitly aimed at the creation of democracy and socialism. The opening editorial of the paper, you know, addressed, you know, to the people, invoked the, quote, the beautiful revolutionary dream of the slaves of Rome to serve the interests of the people and to defend their liberties. Now, whether or not Karl Marx actually read this paper, I'm not really sure, but not surprisingly, Karl Marx himself is also known to be an admirer of Spartacus. Unfortunately for Marx, there were no full-colour posters of Kirk Douglas to put up on his bedroom wall. Sorry for touching on anachronisms again. In fact, though, what you know, Marx would have relied on entirely, and anything that he could have known about Spartacus would have come from some of the official published histories of Roman histories that were you know, passed down and published. And luckily for Marx, he was prepared to read books, written by, even by scumbags like Roman historians. Now, in 1861, as usual, the Marx family was destitute and poor, and while they were waiting for, waiting to depart for a trip to Holland to seek assistance from some of their wealthier relatives, Marx spent his evening reading, or perhaps rereading, an account of the Spartacus Rising written by the ruling class Roman historian by the name of Appian. Marx was probably reading in the original Greek, as you do, despite the fact that Appian's account of the Third Civil War was one of the most hostile accounts, though, I think it's fair to say that Marx was absolutely captivated by the role that Spartacus is reported to have played, and that even, you know, Appian was kind of forced to admit. In a letter to his best friend and collaborator, Frederick Engels, Marx gushes about Spartacus, writing that he was, quote, the finest fellow produced by the whole of classical history, a real representative of the ancient proletariat. But not surprisingly, again, Marx was also unequivocally hostile to the other side, to the Roman rulers who had crushed the Spartacus uprising. And one of the particular praetors or Roman generals who used the defeat of Spartacus as a springboard for his own ascendancy in the Roman Empire was a guy called Pompey. And I think this guy particularly caught Marx's ire because he kind of did a little postscript on the bottom of the note to Engels saying, that Pompey's a real shit. Just a few years later, though, in 1865, Marx was responding to a questionnaire being playfully administered by his daughters. I think there was a habit of this in the Marx family. And asked, amongst other things, to name his hero, Marx said two people. He said Spartacus and the astronomer Johannes Kepler. Now, Kepler may have been famous for his laws of planetary motion, but I think fair to say Spartacus was popular with Marx for less celestial reasons. And, you know, Kepler was all very rational and whatnot, but, you know, really I think Marx's enthusiasm for Spartacus was, you know, again, this sense of rebelliousness, this figure of rebellion in history, something that Marx himself, you know, wanted to see, revisited time and time again and recognised the potential for. And so, you know, enthusiasm for Spartacus, not surprisingly, became widespread amongst socialists and communists in the earliest 20th century. But, of course, Marx's real contribution to history and to politics was not so much in promoting a cult of Spartacus. Instead, it was his whole theory of history and struggle summarised in his own writing at the start of the Communist Manifesto, where he says, and I quote, "The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggle. Freeman and slave, patrician and plebeian, lord and serf, guildmaster and journeyman, in a word, oppressor and oppressed, stood in constant opposition to one another, carried on an uninterrupted, now hidden, now open fight, a fight that each time ended either in the revolutionary reconstitution of society at large or in the common ruin of the contending classes." And what does Marx mean here? Now, I don't have time to give a whole talk on the opening words of the Communist Manifesto, but I think, you know, a few key points. First, you know, Marx was recognising that you cannot have classes without class division. You cannot have classes without class division. But he also recognised that our side, the side of the oppressed, doesn't always win. And I think that's important. In the case of Spartacus and the rebellion that he led, the contending slaves were eventually ruined, but not before they had given, you know, Rome one of the bloodiest noses that it ever had. Eventually, too, though, the Roman Empire was also ruined, and centuries of darkness and backwardness followed with the Middle Ages in Europe. But if we're going to understand a little more than Marx tells us about Spartacus, we need to start with understanding, obviously, more about ancient Rome. And believe me, Rome wasn't all what I think, you know, many historians would like it to be made out to be. It wasn't just about men and predominantly men waddling around in togas, you know, draped in the bar, you know, doughy-eyed slaves peeling grapes for them, and, you know, isn't it lovely, and we can have another bath now, and we're going to take our toga off now. No, that's not Roman. That was not what Roman society was about. Rome was a brutal class-divided society. Roman society was in no sense a real democracy. The constitution of the early Roman Republic gave a monopoly of power to the hereditary elite of so-called patrician families. All significant roles in the Roman state were held by these patricians as senators, as judges, as praetors, or military generals. There were bogus, you know, so-called elections, allocating a minority of votes to the what were known as plebeians, or the small peasants. And the propertyless Roman labourers, the workers, had, brace yourselves, one vote between them. At the time of the Spartacus uprising, the Roman Republic was entering a period of turmoil that would end with the rule of the Caesars and the heightened barbarity of the empire. Roman territories were expanding east and west. Ambitious generals would make a name fighting for Spain or Macedonia, and then coming back and carving out something of a political career for themselves in Rome. The Roman Empire was consequently in an almost constant state of war abroad. As the poorer peasants grew poorer, one of the ways the Roman Empire could continue to guarantee the acquiescence of the peasants was to expand its land holdings through territorial wars, and then to resettle the peasants into the new territory. This would relieve their plight for a while, but of course the process continued on, and the wars of conquest would, over time, lead to diminishing returns for the peasants. Most of Rome's loot from conquest went to the rich, not surprisingly, and the peasant economy was hurt by also the fact of conscription into the legions, which prevented peasants from cultivating the land and made it, of course, harder for them to pay debts and taxes. The wars also produced a massive new labour force for the Roman ruling elite to exploit, because all of the captives of war were enslaved, and so the slave population in Rome grew enormously. Basically because it was cheaper for large landowners to buy slaves than pay landless labourers' wages. Over a period of time, slaves became the major labour force in the Republic, and the growth of slavery naturally also led to the growing impoverishment of the mass of free labourers in Rome as well, driving them out of work. Ironically, the total free population of Rome actually stagnated or even fell as the Roman Empire went from strength to strength, because frankly, the bulk of the people could not afford to, you know, even increase their families. And the slave population grew massively to represent something in the order of 2 million people compared to 3.25 million in the so-called free population. Essentially, the whole of the Roman Empire became like one big prison camp with lots and lots and lots of slaves and a huge number of disaffected peasants and labourers. But this class, massive, you know, class polarisation in Roman society bred, as you can imagine, and as Marx, you know, rightly says, whole new waves of civil conflicts, you know, not least of which, of course, was the conflicts between the slaves and their rulers themselves. It's important to note that the class oppression, though, of other social layers in Rome was part of the reason why the slave rebellion, when it did break out, was able to succeed as much as it did, because, you know, some of these other class layers could be drawn into kind of relishing in seeing the rich suffer just as much as the slaves obviously did. Now, let's talk more about the slaves themselves. Now, the dominant ideology in Roman society was that slaves were fortunate to have not been killed in battle by invading Roman armies. The idea was that they were alive simply because of the mercy of their captors, and so they should be grateful for their life. And so not surprisingly, in a legal sense, slave owners also had the legal power over life and death, you know, of their property, which was their slaves. The only really effective form of coercion available to the owners for keeping slaves in a kind of productive check was through various forms of gross brutality And in Rome, that meant harsh treatment, torture, all kinds of, you know, really sinister and painful forms of death. One of the main forms of execution in Rome was crucifixion, which, you know, for those who aren't familiar, is a kind of lingering and agonizing death that could last for, you know, days, hanging, you know, rotting on a wooden cross. Other punishments included things like being burnt alive or perhaps, you know, being forced into gladiatorial combat. Most slaves were given the worst possible jobs that you can imagine, with, you know, the most kind of diabolical conditions. For example, mining. I mean, imagine mining in ancient Rome. Imagine what it would be like, you know, being thousands of meters under the ground, or in chain gangs, in plantations, or, you know, perhaps if you're perhaps a bit luckier as a shepherd. Slaves were drawn from different places across the empire, from North Africa, from the Middle East, from Asia, and around Europe. They spoke different languages. They shared different cultures. And, you know, the punishment, though, for revolt by the slaves was, you know, death, really. The slaves had no legal means or right to organize. They therefore had to plot in complete secrecy for detection at any time before a revolt meant certain failure. Even if slaves were able to organize in one plantation or one mine, it was extremely difficult for them to organize, you know, other sites. Some of this explains why major slave revolts had rarely gotten off the ground until then. All it had, you know, really taken was for one or a couple of loyal slaves to, you know, reveal the plot, reveal the conspiracy, or one captured slave to confess under pain of torture or perhaps the hope of leniency, and, you know, it was all over. It was therefore extremely difficult, if not impossible, to actually unite slaves or for slaves to organize and unify themselves in a class-conscious way and to assert their own collective desire for freedom. And I think this is really kind of what makes the Spartacus uprising the most, you know, really impressive in a way, because despite all of those factors, they were able to achieve something. But it also kind of partly explains why the rebellion in Rome was actually started amongst gladiators, who were a section of slaves that were trained in military combat and familiar with arms and that kind of thing. Now, as I've kind of intimated, Rome was a militaristic society, and one of the expressions of this was the newly popular entertainment of, you know, TV advertisement, gladiatorial combat, you know. Now, this brutal sport, and I'm sure people have seen movies, there's a million movies with Russell Crowe and various other horrible digitized burly men. So gladiatorial combat was very popular. And just to give people a bit of a flavor of how this developed, I mean, at its kind of height, Julius Caesar celebrated a triumph over his enemies in the civil war in 46 BC by staging huge shows with wild beast hunts, fully fledged gladiatorial battles in what was called the Circus Maximus, with 500 infantry, 30 cavalry, 20 elephants on either side. And then, you know, the games became even more barbaric, with literally, you know, thousands of gladiators being pitted against each other, killing each other, slaughtering each other, all promoted by the Roman ruling class as a way of trying to placate or, you know, entertain the so-called free population of Rome. Now, Spartacus was a gladiatorial slave in training. He was originally from a place called Thrace, which I believe is the present-day Bulgaria. So it's out of, you know, the Italian peninsula. He's wasn't Italian, as, you know, some people might like to claim. Despite his well-deserved fame, though, not much is actually really known about Spartacus the person. Of course, we know that it's always the victors who write history, and the voices of slaves throughout the centuries can only be heard through the accounts of their oppressors. What little information we have is from accounts written by Spartacus's mortal enemies, people like Appian, who I've mentioned, or Plutarch, some of the Roman historians who, you know, in many cases were writing about these events decades or even centuries after they'd actually happened. It's worth noting, though, that there were other leaders of the revolt whose names have come down to us, people like, some of these names are interesting, Crixus, Castus, Gannicus, Owen Emmaus. Try saying that one. Owen Emmaus. Gladiators from, you know, places like Gaul and Germania, other parts of Europe. But even less about these leaders is known. Whatever the case, though, I think it was clear that Spartacus became the leader in the year 73 BC, or possibly, you know, one of several leaders of, at first, a tiny band of rebel gladiators, but then what grew to become an army of, you know, well over 100,000 slaves. 100,000 slaves. I mean, this is a massive army. That by the end, really required the very full force of the Roman military that was needed to actually crush them. The Spartacus War was set against a backdrop of at least two, though, earlier wars, smaller revolts. The island of Sicily in the Mediterranean, where huge numbers of slaves were congregated on pastoral and agricultural lands, had been the epicenter of slave revolts both 60 and 30 years prior to the Spartacus Rising. In both of these cases, tens of thousands of slaves, mostly herders and agricultural slaves, had risen up and been supported by the local free population in doing so. But of course, Sicily was, well away from Rome, from the capital of the Republic, and isolated by sea. And whilst these earlier rebellions had actually, raised the possibility of slave struggle, they were nowhere near as significant as the revolt of Spartacus, which really rocked the entire Italian, it wasn't called Italy then, but the entire Italian peninsula. So the uprising started in 73 BC, and as I said, it started amongst gladiators. A layer of slaves that were trained in military combat, trained to kill each other. And I guess it's particularly not surprising when you think about it that it started here, because after all, these gladiators had like nothing to lose but their own kind of ceremonial death in an auditorium. And I think as Roman, the Roman historian Appian, the one that, Marx was reading before that he commented on, accurately put it, the gladiators decided to, quote, strike for their own freedom rather than for the amusement of spectators. I think it gives you a sense of what it was like. Spartacus had been trained at a gladiatorial school near a place called Capua, and it was here that Spartacus and his fellow gladiators armed themselves, overpowered their guards, and escaped. And so, armed with the knives that they'd stolen from the kitchen and a wagon full of weapons that they managed to pull together, the slaves fled from there to the slopes of the mighty Mount Vesuvius near modern-day Naples. And this is before Mount Vesuvius had kind of blown its top and covered Pompeii in ash. So it's 2,000 years ago, remember? Now, the news of the gladiators' breakout encouraged others to follow. A steady flow of rural slaves soon joined the mutineers, whose numbers began to swell. The group overran the region, raiding farms for food and supplies. The rebels, began to actually win a series of small victories, which, then led to bigger things. And Plutarch, who I've mentioned, who's another Roman ruling class historian, writes this in his account. He says, "First then, routing those that came out of Capua against them and thus procuring a quantity of proper soldiers' arms, they gladly threw away their own as barbarous and dishonorable." Now, I think you can kind of almost picture the exhilaration with which these gladiators, kind of breaking out. The kind of joy with which they, are able to kind of cast away their old uniforms of their trade, the gladiatorial trade, and actually dress themselves as proper soldiers, as rebellious soldiers, and not as slaves. But I think this little detail from Plutarch reveals something more important than weapons and equipment. It reveals a growing confidence and a rejection not only of the servile state, of servile reality for slaves, but also of the servile way of thinking, the servile mentality. This is, I think, a really important point about slave rebellion, which, involves much more than just a rejection of your existence as a slave, but a complete rejection of the system that reduces, and all of the ideas that go along with the system of reducing human beings to being essentially just the means of production for a ruling class. The slave revolt in 73 BC managed to achieve some brilliant tactical manoeuvres. Spartacus was an excellent military tactician. He was a formidable enemy for the Romans. His army, though, it has to be said, was mainly composed of poorly armed and untrained former slave labourers. And, this really dictated his tactics, which, at first were fairly defensive for some time. They hid out on the heavily forested Mount Vesuvius to train people and to prepare. Realizing, of course, that the time was running out before some kind of a serious battle would ensue, Spartacus delegated to his gladiatorial comrades the task of actually training some of the recruits in small groups, who then trained other small groups and so on. And this way, he was able to create, from scratch, a fully trained army in a matter of weeks. And what the slave army lacked in military experience, they really made up for with the heroism of people fighting for their survival, with literally nothing to lose but their own chains or their own death. There were many skirmishes with the Roman army, and many of which ended in victory. For example, the first major one, Publius Varinus, who was a praetor, a general sent by the Senate, the first to be sent by the Senate, against the escaped slaves. He had 2,000 men, and you know, basically the Spartacus army fought him and totally routed him. And you know, they did a lot of routing, the Spartacus army. They really did. They managed to defeat a whole series of armies. Cassinius, who was the next person to sell, another praetor with another lot of soldiers, was sent. And you know, he actually narrowly missed being captured in person. You know, it wasn't just his legions. The slaves, you know, followed the retreating Romans, slaughtered lots of them. Finally, they stormed the Roman camp, and actually, Cassinius himself was finally killed as well. So, you know, with every one of these smaller victories, you can see the morale of the rebels started to grow and really increase. And you can imagine that the reports going back to the Senate in Rome, you know, were pretty grim, you know, from the senator's point of view. Slowly the truth was beginning to dawn in the minds of even the most kind of dull-witted aristocrats that here they were facing, you know, a really dangerous enemy, one that was, you know, possessed a vast number of reserves, infiltrated in the very heart of the enemy camp, on every farm, in every household, there were slaves, each of whom was a potential rebel to be watched with suspicion and fear. And, you know, after some of these successful battles, the fame of Spartacus, you know, really, as you can imagine, amongst slaves, really grew. The message was clear to all, the Romans were no longer invincible. Now, despite some fairly incredible military victories, the slave armies did make some tactical errors, and it wasn't all kind of up and away. They were eventually crushed, after all. And so we need to understand, you know, some of the factors for this. But one of them was that there were real divisions amongst the slaves. You know, there was real unity there, but there were sources of division. Division that the Romans were, over a period of time, able to get better at exploiting. There were divisions in the kind of ideas about which tactics to take. There were language divisions, there were ethnic divisions, there were religious divisions amongst the slaves that the Romans could try and exploit. And it was this that, you know, was one of the first real setbacks for Spartacus. The Roman Senate, after some of its initial defeats, sent two further legions with a couple more people called Gilius, Publicola, and Gnaeus Cornelius Lentulius Claudianus. I studied botany, by the way. I think these people sound like weeds. So they were sent against the slaves, who at this stage were in northern Italy. Spartacus here, I think, faced his greatest challenge. An army of two legions, 10,000 men commanded, you know, by another person, Cassinius Longinus, who was a local governor in northern Italy. And here, Rome scored a victory when they defeated one of the contingents of the rebel army, the Gaulish contingent led by a person called Crixus. Now, Crixus and the Gauls had refused to march directly under Spartacus's leadership. They were part of the army, but kind of not directly under it. It seems that there was a tactical dispute as well. Crixus wanted to stay in Italy. He was, you know, as some people say, seduced by the plunder. Sounded very romantic to be plundering around the place. He was rather seduced by that. And, you know, and then some historians say that he maybe even wanted to lead a charge on Rome itself, that it was much more about escape. Whereas Spartacus wanted to continue over the Alps into Gaul, into the, you know, the land of milk and honey, apparently, over the mountains and out of the grasp of Rome. And Plutarch wrote this about it. He said, "But they, the Gauls, growing confident in their numbers and puffed up with their successes, would give no obedience to Spartacus, but went about and ravaged Italy." Now, I wish I could read the rest of the quote, but you'll have to go and read it yourself. It's really quite funny. But for this reason, Crixus left Spartacus, and he took around 30,000 Gauls and Germans with him in his part of the army. And this split was really a disastrous mistake. Crixus was defeated by the Roman consul Publicola and fell in battle. The Gauls paid a terrible price for this, and 20,000 of them were killed. And this was the first warning of the dangerous consequences of division in the ranks of the slave army. But Spartacus, in true leadership style, wasn't at all spiteful about this, well, wasn't outwardly spiteful about this. And to celebrate, to honour the leader Crixus, he held a bout of gladiatorial games with some Roman soldiers that they captured, made them fight each other, killed each other, and made sure that the Roman Senate knew exactly about it. And what better way, of course, to forge some solidarity amongst your own ranks than to totally mock your oppressors? And you can imagine how utterly, utterly horrified the Roman senators and rulers were when they heard about this. I mean, psychologically, this was like a massive shame job. You know, this was really, you know, disturbed their inner toga. So the Roman soldiers being made into gladiators. They were absolutely furious at the consuls. They ordered them to keep out of the conflict, and instead they put a new praetor, Marcus Licinius Crassus, don't forget that name, in charge of the war. Now, Crassus was the richest man in Rome. He was the Berlusconi of Rome, perhaps even worse, if you can imagine. He was an ambitious politician. He was hungry for glory. Putting Crassus in charge of the Roman effort was a bit like putting Hannibal Lecter in charge of the liver transplant ward or something like that. Crassus was, he was the villain that everyone loved to hate. And Plutarch, sorry to return to Plutarch's words, describes one of the ways that Crassus liked to get rich, and you have to listen to this. Plutarch says, Crassus observed what frequent and everyday occurrences in Roman were. Fire and collapse of buildings owing to their size and their close proximity to each other. He therefore bought slaves who were architects and builders, and then, when he had more than 500 of them, he would buy up houses that were either on fire themselves or near the scene of the fire. The owners of these properties, in the terror and uncertainty of the moment, would let them go to Crassus for next to nothing. In this way, most of Rome came into Crassus' possession. So you can see, he wasn't an idiot. He kind of had some idea about how to manipulate people. And he was no fool as well when it came to actually the battle against Spartacus. He, you know, really didn't underestimate his opponents. And his aim was to carefully build up his forces and avoid a decisive battle, confident that in the end, the superior resources and wealth of Rome would wear down the rebels and create favourable conditions for a military victory. However, many of those legionaries that actually joined Crassus on this kind of grand mission to, in the kind of pursuit of glory, they didn't actually, I don't think, share the understanding of his enemy that, share his understanding of the enemy they were confronted with. A lot of them were kind of rich young fops who, you know, were really kind of in for the blood sport kind of thing. I kind of have this image of, Prince William and Kate Middleton out on the fox hunts, you know, doing their, you know, with their little entourage. It's that kind of a thing. And I think this kind of excessive overconfidence was actually, you know, a problem for Crassus. And so while Crassus stayed on the borders of Picenum, expecting Spartacus would come that way, he said to one of his lieutenants, Mummius, he sent one of his lieutenants called Mummius with two of the legions to observe the enemy's movements. They gave him strict orders on no account was he to engage in a skirmish or, you know, to engage them in any way. They were ordered to capture a small hill, but to do it quietly as possible and not to alert the enemy, just to kind of watch. But overconfident, of course, on his first opportunity, Mummius started a battle and was, you know, absolutely heavily defeated by the slaves. In fact, they would have been, you know, totally annihilated had it not been for the fact that Crassus mobilized a lot of his forces at that point and engaged the battle. And, you know, it really proved to be a very, very bloody battle with, you know, huge numbers of men slain. And a great many of Crassus's legionaries only saved because they threw down their arms and ignominiously, you know, kind of ran away, basically. But by contrast, writes Plutarch, of the slaves, one out of 12,300 rebels who Crassus killed, out of 12,300 rebels who Crassus killed, only two were found with wounds in their back. The rest all having died standing in their ranks and, you know, bravely fighting Crassus's army. And I think this bravery of the slaves contrasts with the kind of cowardly conduct of the Romans in earlier battles, which then, you know, compelled Crassus, though, at this point, to revive an ancient Roman method of punishment within his own army, something called decimation. Now, if you were here earlier, you'll have heard me talk about the chapter in this book by Barry Strauss. There's a chapter called The Decimator. Worth reading if you want a bit of, you know, sinister bedtime, you know, thing. But I'll just give you a brief sketch. Crassus, the method of decimation, Crassus selected 500, the 500 men who'd kind of run away first, you know, the most kind of cowardice kind of his soldiers. And then he divided them into 50 groups of 10, and each one of the group was to die by lot. So they were going to basically kill off, they were told, they were forced to kill off 1/10 of their own, you know, deci, which means 10, decimated. They were going to basically slaughter 1/10 of their own. And you can imagine, like, this was a pretty terrible punishment, not that I've got huge amount of sympathy. But and it was a punishment that had long fallen into disuse in the Roman army. But by reviving it, Crassus really wanted to show to his army that he meant business. This was about stealing, you know, the forces of reaction against the slave army. And from this moment, every Roman soldier learned to fear his general more than he feared his slaves. But look, there's a lot more to say about the narrative. I want to say that after bottling Spartacus in at the south of Italy across the Rhegian Peninsula, Crassus eventually was able to defeat Spartacus. Plutarch, again, no doubt with a lot of creative license this time, describes the final battle in which Spartacus and his army fell to Crassus, and I quote, "As fresh supplies came in on either side, Spartacus, seeing that there was no avoiding it, set all his army in array. And when his horse was brought to him, he drew out his sword and killed it, saying, if he got the day, he should have a great many better horses of the enemy. And if he lost it, he should have no need of this. And so, making directly towards Crassus himself, through the midst of arms and wounds, he missed him, but slew two centurions that fell upon him together. At last, being deserted by those who were about him, he himself stood his ground and, surrounded by the enemy, bravely defending himself, was cut to pieces." Now, the remaining captured rebels, there's 6,000 of them at that point, were crucified by the Romans along the Appian Way, which is basically a major thoroughfare from Capua to Rome, to set an example. And these half-dead and then dead and then rotting bodies were hung on these crosses for years and years to come. Now, absolutely terrifying passers-by and reminding slaves throughout Rome that, you know, Rome had been the victor of this battle. In the end, Pompey, who I mentioned earlier, the one that Marx thought was a shit, was sent after Crassus to mop up some of the remnants of the army, and Pompey ended up with more credit, actually, than Crassus in defeating Spartacus in the end. But you'll be happy to know that Crassus later died, was killed, trying to conquer someone else in Asia. Now, that's the end of the kind of core part of the narrative here. But I think the key here, and you know, it's to just recognise the incredible effort, despite all the odds, that the slaves were able to mount, you know, these oppressed human beings against their oppressors. I mean, just the most incredible struggle that lasted for well over a year. And as I said, really rocked the whole of Rome as they marched from one end of the Italian, the whole of the Roman Republic, as they marched from one end of Italy to another. And even though the Spartacus revolt didn't and perhaps couldn't have led to an end to class division and tyranny within the Roman Republic, the memory of Spartacus lives on as a symbol of power, of the power of the oppressed masses to confront their oppressors. It retains all its force and is an inspiration for all those today who fight for their rights. And it's no accident that during the First World War, after the, wind forward 2,000 years, after the disastrous opportunism of the workers' movement to support German imperialism and Germany's involvement in the war, that Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht adopted the name of the Roman revolutionary Spartacus when they launched the Spartacus League of Communist Revolutionaries. I think Karl Marx and Luxemburg and Liebknecht were right to invoke the legacy of Spartacus for the socialist movement. And I think we here in Socialist Alternative are proud to stand in a tradition of struggle, of rebellion, and of opposition to all of those who would seek to enrich themselves at the expense of the great majority of us. So, let's talk about Spartacus.